Hello, Sean Zabashi here. Welcome back to another episode in our sprawling exploration of prehistoric cave art and all the interesting side paths it leads us down. I am very excited for this episode. We're going to talk about some really cool things. I've been waiting quite a while to get to this part. And obviously, the episodes are best if you listen to them in sequential order, but if you don't feel like listening to the previous eight episodes, I do recommend listening to at least 3.6, because in that episode we went over a fairly standard textbook summary of modern cave art studies. We talked about how the field weirdly had two beginnings, and then we talked about how different explanations for why prehistoric people would make cave art sort of rose and fell throughout the decades. That episode, 3.6, is a good one to listen to before this one. It provides a sort of foundation for this one, because we're going to start this episode by taking a closer look at some of that history. And it turns out that if you look at the right things, or if you look at that history in the right way, you get to some very mind-bending conundrums and weird things that sort of launch you into some very cool philosophy that I'm very excited about. And I want to begin this episode with a quote. As a sort of epigraph, you know, something to both introduce it and something to keep in mind throughout. It's a quote from the influential physicist David Bohm, who developed an interpretation of quantum mechanics that's still relevant today, as well as being one of those, you know, brilliant polymath physicist types. The quote is from a 1977 lecture. He says, quote, "Reality is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is based upon our perceptions. What we perceive depends on what we look for. What we look for depends on what we think. What we think depends on what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. What we take to be true is our reality." Unquote. So, it's a quote that's kind of meant to be confusing in a fun way, so don't despair if it gets you all mixed up, if that sounded very confusing, if you can make heads or tails of it. I definitely had to read it a few times myself, and I'll put it in the episode description too, so you can also read it a few times. And I'll read it again now. Quote, "Reality is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is based upon our perceptions. What we perceive depends on what we look for. What we look for depends on what we think. What we think depends on what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. What we take to be true is our reality." Unquote. So, it's a really fun quote, I think. It really twists you around. I really recommend also trying to pick holes in it. Like, there's a few connections in there that I think are maybe a little iffy. Some of those statements can be challenged more than others. But it's really fun to try to think it through yourself. So maybe I'll read it one more time, and then we'll descend into the caves. "Reality is what we take to be true. What we take to be true is what we believe. What we believe is based upon our perceptions. What we perceive depends on what we look for. What we look for depends on what we think. What we think depends on what we perceive. What we perceive determines what we believe. What we believe determines what we take to be true. What we take to be true is our reality." We are going to be taking a closer look at the history of modern cave art studies, as well as some theories and philosophies that are relevant to what we'll uncover, through the eyes of Mats Rosengren, who wrote a book in 2012 called Cave Art, Perception, and Knowledge, where he looks at cave art and its history, and then tries to extract broader conclusions from it about things as deep as how we know things and how we perceive things. So let's go all the way back to Sans de Satuola and his discovery of the prehistoric cave art at Altamira, where Picasso visited decades later and, apocryphally, said, "In 15,000 years, we have invented nothing." And as a side note, people get all caught up when it comes to apocryphal statements, trying to figure out whether it's true or false, whether Picasso actually said that, but, you know, that's not really the main point of apocryphal statements. The reason that they stick around so much, even though there's no proof, is because the literal truth of the event isn't the main point. It's kind of like a casual mythology, right? A mythology that just naturally develops, in this case about Altamira and cave art and art in general. But anyways, sans de Satuola, it turns out that his discovery involves a few things that are often not mentioned, or at least not mentioned by me when we went over it the first time. In fact, it was not sans de Satuola himself who first discovered the paintings, who first saw the paintings as art, as images, but his 8-year-old daughter, Maria. It was 1879, and sans de Satuola had been exploring the cave since 1875, although I don't think it was super consistent. I think this might have been only his second time back. Various sources disagreed, but it's not like he was there every day. This time, he decided to bring his daughter along, and he was mainly focused on the ground. He was looking for evidence of habitation, and his daughter was, meanwhile, exploring the cave as children do, until at one point she stared at the ceiling and yelled, "Look, Papa, oxen!"
Maria? Maria!
Dancing drawings.
Go back to school here.
No.
Oh.
See, they move.
What is it, my dear? What moves?
The stones.
What is it? Stones? Look like oxen?
No, look. A whole herd, Papa. This one's standing and this one isn't finished yet. Who painted them, Papa? Was it the primitives?
I don't know, Maria.
The weird thing is that now that we know about the paintings, the animals on the ceiling at Altamira are pretty much impossible not to see. Once his daughter pointed them out, sans de Satuola also couldn't not see them. They're right there, so large, so looming, so many of them. So why didn't he see them earlier? We're gonna build up an answer to that question. And first off, it turns out there's an interesting, not super definitive or anything, but something interesting to mention about the history of cave art. Mats Rosengren says, quote, "One might claim that in the history of the discovery of cave art, the scientists are, as it were, the naive ones needing to be taught what they should look for, whereas local guides and children, seemingly not suffering from well-entrenched perceptual prejudices, seem more apt at perceiving the pictures as pictures." Why is this so? How are we to explain this inability amongst trained scholars to see what there is to see? Unquote. And again, this is just an offhand comment, so nothing definitive, but I mention it because it'll lead us where we're going. Rosengren is using cave art to ask these wider philosophical questions, the main one of which can be summarized by saying, what was it that made children and local guides more able to see cave art at the beginning than studied prehistorians? Rosengren himself had been obsessed with cave art since he was a child and was taken by his father to visit Altamira. As he progressed in academia, cave art, always within him since his childhood experience, began to come to the forefront again, as he realized that cave art and the study of cave art, and just maybe caves in general, are good to think with, as the saying goes, that caves and philosophy seem drawn to each other for some reason. He says, quote, "Caves and philosophy go well together. In its very beginning, Western philosophy appropriated the cave, most eminently through Plato's famous simile in Book 7 of the Republic, as a metaphor for the human situation. Ever since, the chief objective of man appears to have been to get out of his troglodytic settings, to free his mind of the shadows, the smoke, and the images coming out of the deep recesses of the earth. Metaphysics as we know it is all but unthinkable without the image of the cave, and, no doubt, without the images in the caves. The constant urge in Western thinking to find an absolute beginning cannot, it seems, free itself from this Chthonian fantasy. It is as if the emergence of mankind inevitably has to be connected with coming out of the earth, breaking free in an upward surge towards the stars and the sun, leaving body and matter behind. Enlightenment is but a metaphorical prolongation of such a tortuous thinking. This book is about bringing thinking and philosophy back into the caves again. It is about what the mind can find in the caves, as well as what the caves can bring to the mind." Unquote. This is how he opens his book, an extremely cool way of introducing the topic. And it's true. Nearly since the beginning of philosophy, caves play a major metaphorical role. Just for anyone who doesn't know, briefly, Plato's cave is described by Socrates as a cave where people have been chained since childhood in a way where they can't turn around. They can only face the back wall of the cave, and behind them is a fire, and between the fire and the chained people walk people carrying all sorts of things, creating a performance of shadows on the walls. The philosopher, according to Socrates and Plato, is the person who breaks free from the chains, turns around, and faces the light of the sun to see things how they actually are. I love that idea of the history of philosophy as breaking out of the cave and then flying above the earth. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like a Western example of a common form of creation myth in worldwide cultures called emergence myths. These are creation myths where the beginning of the world and humanity involves emerging from some subterranean world. So it's very cool to look at the history of Western philosophy as, you know, having its own sort of creation myth. And I also love that Rosengren describes this book as going against this motion, going back into the caves. He says, quote, "This book advances a specific perspective. We should not try to get out of our human cave, but work on getting to know it even better. We must realize that there is no enlightenment waiting outside the den. Rather than projecting our hopes towards distant suns and stars, we should look for the mind in the cave." Unquote. This might seem weird at first because, you know, even me who talks about caves until everyone else is like, can we please talk about something else? Even I don't really enjoy the idea of living in a cave. My instinct is like Plato's, to try to break out of any cave that I'm in, especially if I'm chained. Caves are cool to go into for a bit, but I definitely don't want to live in one. But Rosengren is building up to a point. In that earlier, longer passage, there were the lines, "The constant urge in Western thinking to find an absolute beginning cannot, it seems, free itself from this Chthonian fantasy. It is as if the emergence of mankind inevitably has to be connected with coming out of the earth, breaking free in an upward surge towards the stars and the sun, leaving body and matter behind. Enlightenment is but a metaphorical prolongation of such tortuous thinking." And maybe you thought he was just being a drama queen and didn't really think too much about that part of the passage, but he truly means it. Can you see where he's going yet? The point he's making is that so much of history of Western thought, and especially Enlightenment thought, you know, like the rationality and science of modernity, is trying to get an objective view of reality, trying to understand the world as it really is by erasing the human, by trying to get beyond subjectivity, trying to obtain a God's eye view, But Rosengren is going to argue that this isn't possible, because this isn't how knowledge works. This isn't even how perception works. Rosengren builds heavily upon the work of a few scholars to make his case, mainly Ludwig Fleck, Ernst Cassirer, and Cornelius Castoriadis. Unfortunately, going thoroughly through all those people would take a really long time, so this will only be a superficial version. But one of those people has an interesting way of adding to this notion that we can never escape the cave, a good place to start. Cornelius Castoriadis, a post-war Greek philosopher, says, quote, "To think is not to exit the cave, nor to replace the uncertainty of the shadows with the clear-cut contours of the things themselves, the flickering light of a flame with the true light of the sun. It is to enter the labyrinth, or more exactly, to make the labyrinth be and appear, whereas we could have stayed on our backs among the flowers facing the sun. To think is to lose oneself in the galleries that exist only because they are relentlessly excavated by us. It is to move around in circles at the end of a dead-end gallery where the entrance has closed behind us, until this circular movement inexplicably opens cracks in the walls that we can use." The myth definitely wanted to tell us something important when it presented the labyrinth as the work of Daedalus, a man. Unquote. That's another passage that it takes a while to wrap your mind around. You can chew on it for a while. Pretty much all the quotes in this episode will be like that. What he's trying to say is that often people think about learning things, about acquiring knowledge, as though there's a world out there, and all we have to do is scientifically record data, like get the facts, as though they're like, you know, things in a grocery store. I'm going to get these things. And then out of these facts, you create an objective picture of the world. As long as you're not swayed by your biases or prejudices or preconceived notions. But Rosengren and these other thinkers disagree. Maybe there are some cases where that's what happens, but they think that, by and large, knowledge is created, not simply obtained. Series 2 is about this in a different way, if you want further reasons for why this is. And before any of you go all Jordan Peterson and start freaking out about this, about how it's postmodern meaninglessness, an attack on our values of knowledge and objective reality, Rosengren hastens to note that he doesn't want to abandon truth or knowledge or intentionality or anything like that. He just has a different view of how human collectives relate to meaning and knowledge. He calls his approach doxological. And actually, what Rosengren is trying to do is find a way to thread the needle between relativism and objectivism. Which, I mean, to me it seems like this is what often these people are trying to do. Only very strange people, or propagandistic people, like Jordan Peterson, think that there's like a whole bunch of scholars trying to instill utter relativism into society, where one person calls an object a tree, and another person calls it a giraffe, and you can't criticize either person. Like, but you actually have to read people seriously and thoroughly to understand their proposed third option, something Peterson, I don't think, does too much. Something beyond or between objectivism and relativism is going to be a lot more complicated than either of those two, especially in the simplistic ways they're often discussed, where the objective is synonymized with the truth by someone who thinks that their version of reality is obviously correct, and where relativism is synonymized with complete meaninglessness, where nobody can communicate because everyone has an incommensurably personal, singular worldview, utterly distinct from anyone else's. And sorry for ranting like this. One reason that sort of thinking pisses me off is that there's so many cool things you can uncover and so many cool things to think about once you stop being like, there's an objective reality, and it turns out, just coincidentally, that that reality is objectively the way that I think it is, but it's objective and all those other people are relativists. Like, it's just, it's a little maddening to have to listen to that all the time. And before you say, well, why are you listening to them then? I try not to. It's very hard to go online without running into them. It's... Anyways, So what does Rosengren mean by doxological or doxology? It turns out that it, like so many things in philosophy, goes back to the Greeks. In fact, Rosengren is trying with this book to reinvigorate the term, which isn't really popular these days except in some theological contexts. The Greek word is doxa, and Rosengren sees the ancient philosopher Protagoras as being the prototypical doxologist. We'll get further into what exactly that means, of course, but I think a good way to begin unraveling it is to oppose it to the ancient Greek concept that's a lot more influential, and the notion that Rosengren is arguing against, episteme. Episteme is the word that epistemology comes from, the word for the branch of philosophy that deals with knowledge, like how we know things, how we validate things, different forms of knowing things, how certain we can be about knowing things, stuff like that. This book is epistemological, in one sense, because Rosengren is concerned with knowledge and using the knowledge of cave art as a sort of microcosm that we can focus on to understand knowledge in general. However, Rosengren is opposed to the root of the word epistemology, episteme, because it was used by Plato, and Plato had the view that there was the world we experience, where things live and die and move around and everything is unique. This tree is different from that tree, but there was also this world of the eternal, unchanging reality that contained the pure forms, pure truth. Even though every tree looks different from every other tree, there is some sort of tree-ness, some essence of tree that all trees have, and this tree-ness, this pure form of tree, exists in that world that we don't experience. And I'm not really sure if that's like a physical world. I think this is a way of explaining Plato's philosophy that, is simplistic. I'm not really sure about it. I don't have a comprehensive view of Plato's metaphysics. But the point is that all trees we see are kind of like, you know, slightly deformed versions of this absolute form of tree. And episteme was the word used by Plato to mean knowledge of this eternal reality, knowledge of these pure forms. And as I said, my Plato isn't super great, so I'm sure there's lots to nitpick in that summary. I've heard that Plato framed knowledge as remembering, which is really cool. True learning is actually remembering this world of eternal forms. I've always liked that. But the point is that Rosengren thinks that this notion of truth and knowledge is nonsensical. Episteme, in its Platonic use, is the idea that you can escape Plato's cave, you can emerge, blinking, and see the surface of the earth. But not just that, that's the first step. You can also escape your body, your culture, your language, your conventions, your conceptions, the earth, matter, and somehow access the pure light of knowledge of the sun, metaphorically speaking. Doxa, at least as Rosengren uses it, is the idea that this is a fool's errand, that we can never actually escape the cave, so to speak. The way we improve our understanding of the world and ourselves is not to seek some pure light of knowledge, some god's eye view, but rather to get to know the cave we're in more completely, more thoroughly, and also to learn how to live in a world where everyone is in their own different cave. Although, of course, there's lots of overlap, like within a culture, right? Cultures have, every individual has their own particular worldview, but the culture, broadly, has a sort of worldview as well. A culture is a large part of the cave that everybody from that culture is in, but there are also other things, like someone with a PhD in microbiology shares a part of the cave with other microbiology researchers, no matter what the culture they're in. So we'll get to all this. But the point is, if Rosengren is right, and this goal of pure knowledge is a fiction, an impossibility, then we have to take it into account when dealing with our fellow humans. Instead of just pointing to what we think is objectively true over and over again and tearing out our hair going, why don't they get it? It's so obvious. Like, you know, certain people do. Obviously, Rosengren goes with the cave metaphor because of the subject matter of the book, but it might rub some of you the wrong way because, and I agree here, because I think that implies that everyone is on the same level in a way. Like I think it is possible to escape the cave slightly. Maybe. Or actually, maybe this is a good way to phrase it. That I think keeps the metaphor intact. Like, maybe there's a difference between the person who's chained up in Plato's cave, who thinks the cave is the world, and the person who's chained up, but they know that they're in a cave, or somebody who's just in a cave and they're wandering around trying to figure out, you know, things about the cave. We can keep thinking about this as we continue, but as much as I'm into what Rosengren is putting down, I don't think all knowledge is on the same level. I don't think all worldviews hold the same truth value. But again, that's me comparing it to an objective reality. So, But all this is for later. We still have to figure out what Rosengren means exactly before debating whether it's true or what its flaws are. So he says we should stop trying to find the pure knowledge of the sun, and instead figure out the mind in the cave better, figure out the caves that we're in more thoroughly. He says, quote, "One aim is to show that the increasing importance during the last 4 or 5 decades attached to concepts like creation, construction, or production is by no means a coincidence or the result of a passing postmodern or romantic flair for poesis or creative imagination. Rather, it is the result of a successively more and more conscious and productive reflection." Unquote. Epistemology versus doxology. Plato versus Protagoras. Let's take a closer look at Protagoras now to see how this Greek contrasts to the more famous Plato. He has a famous fragment called the Homo Mensura fragment that Rosengren says perhaps most succinctly puts forth the doxological view. Protagoras says, quote, "Of all things, the measure is man. Of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not, that they are not." Unquote. So, I'm gonna be honest, when I read that the first time, I was pretty underwhelmed. It's not one of those lines that, like, struck me like lightning or anything. Like, sometimes you read a sentence and you're just immediately like, whoa. But that was not the case for me here. "Of all things, the measure is man. Of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not, that they are not." So what does this mean? Why would man be the one who decides what is and what isn't? I don't remember being born, but I'm pretty sure I wasn't given any choices beforehand about what would be in the world when I arrived. Not even the most basic questionnaire. This fragment has a variety of interpretations too. And some, like Rosengren, make it more interesting than others, like Plato. Because this quote really changes depending on what you interpret the word man to mean, right? And I don't just mean it in a sexist way, how man meant humanity or humans back then. Although that's of course part of it. But Plato's interpretation of this fragment that Rosengren argues against is that by man, Protagoras meant every single individual man. So, like, every individual person is going around measuring, and then whether a thing is or isn't is because of that individual person. It's kind of confusing to interpret it that way. In one of Plato's dialogues, Socrates says, "Does Protagoras not say that as each thing appears to me, such is it for me, and as each thing appears to you, such is it to you? And you and I are men, are we not?" And his interlocutor replies, "Yes, he says so." Rosengren thinks that by doing this, Plato is kind of being like the Jordan Peterson of ancient Greece. When Protagoras says that man is the measure of all things, he means individual men. He means that we all live in different worlds. Every individual, everything is completely relativistic. Nothing has any meaning. But Rosengren points out that the word Protagoras uses in that fragment is anthropos, not ener or andros. Those are two other ancient Greek words for man. Anthropos is the Greek word that, yes, can mean individual people, but it can also refer to humanity as a whole, all men and women, unlike those two other words in Greek. So Rosengren is like, you know, if he meant individual men, why would he use this word that's ambiguous, that can mean humanity as a whole? and Rosengren likes this interpretation. Here's how he describes his understanding of Protagoras' fragment. He says, quote, "We human beings live in a world that appears as it does to us because we are what we are. What we know and think about our world does not tell us anything certain about how the world is in itself, since we ourselves are the ultimate measure of what is and what is not. Of course, it might be the case that what we think and know about the world also corresponds to what the real world is like, if it is at all possible to use and understand real in this context. But we have no standard, no scale against which to judge this. All we have is our irredeemably human conception of our world, creating an inescapably human world, in the sense that it is neither objective in the traditional sense, nor species neutral for us to live in and deal with." Unquote. Humanity is a measure of all things because none of us can access objective reality to judge how accurate any view of reality is. This is a common fallacy I see all over the place. Like one example would be like when a black historian releases a book where they look at a majority white place and time with a focus on black people who were there, like medieval England or something, and all these people in the replies to the right-wing news story about it are like, "Oh, come on, this is woke ideology, it's not real objective history." But, you know, what objective history is in their minds, that's only something made by other historians and other people, like, you know, people involved in a historical movie or website or book. None of these people have access to objective history. They only have access to what other people have surmised history to be. And this hypothetical black historian is going, "Hey, this is a blind spot in history that I'm trying to rectify." I'm not saying here that you have to agree with all books like that or anything, but I'm just saying that you have to discount them based on what's actually in the text, because nobody has access to objective history. What we think of as history is a created thing. All we have is the human, and what humans perceive and create. Perhaps I shouldn't have chosen such a controversial example, but you know, maybe it doesn't mesh with your worldview. But the point is that so often people measure things against objective reality, but that objective reality is just something built up by humans and themselves and their perceptions and stuff. Like, nobody has access to the objective world, just the human. I really think thinking like that kind of brings down the stress level a bit when talking to people who have other views, because if there is an objective world that's easily accessible, that's obvious, and all these other people disagree with you about what the objective world is, you start to like lose your mind a bit. You go, what's wrong with them? They're insane. This is a way of kind of dealing with that in a calmer way. At least for me, all we have is the human. Anyways, even if we disregard Plato's interpretation of the fragment, there are some more questions about how it should be interpreted. I'll change it slightly to get us away from the historical sexism and so it's less ambiguous. He says, quote, "Of all things, the measure is humanity, of the things that are, that they are, and of the things that are not," unquote. So the next question is, if indeed that is what Protagoras means, that the measure of things is not the individuals, but rather humanity, you know, what exactly is meant by humanity? Is it like some ability to measure that's common to all people? This is a universalistic interpretation that Rosengren prefers to Plato's solipsistic interpretation, but he still thinks that this isn't exactly what Protagoras meant, or maybe it's not exactly how we should think about what Protagoras could mean to be useful. Rosengren prefers a different interpretation. He says that along with asking what sort of man is the measure of all things, we should also ask, how is whatever Protagoras meant by man measuring in the first place? What exactly does this entail? Rosengren answers, quote, "An answer that probably would have been acceptable even for the historical Protagoras is this: logos is the measure of man, and this again in a double sense. Logos as being in the possession of man, as well as man as being possessed by logos," unquote. Often people think of logos as meaning word or words, but Rosengren reminds us that at least the ancient meaning of logos didn't mean just language or speech. Logos involves the body, too, and perception, and purposeful planned action, and conceptualization, categorization. It's a very broad and polysemic, deep sort of word. So Rosengren alters Protagoras' fragment once more, and this is the version we'll run with. He alters it to say, quote, "Through logos, humanity truly is the measure of everything. Only that which can be experienced as something is, and that which cannot be thus experienced is not," unquote. So, it's all well and good, but how does doxa fit in? Why is it called doxology? Well, because doxa is the product of logos. What logos says is incontrovertibly true. A logos held together by a collective. What a collective of people take to be true. So it's hard to map out in society because we are part of multiple intersecting doxas. He says, quote, "Doxic reality is a procedural reality in constant motion. It is a reality that is not always uniform or free of tensions and contradictions," unquote. So it's not something we can easily point to and like have well-defined boundaries between this doxa and that doxa. But logos and doxa are complementary. The logos produces the doxa, which structures the further logos. They depend on each other. This might all sound confusing, but we're going to build to understanding this. Let's look at Plato again. Plato's argument against this Protagorean fragment is that wine tastes different when you're sick, apparently. I've never heard of this. But then again, who's drinking wine when they're sick? Very funny move. But apparently when you're healthy, wine tastes sweet, and when you're sick, it tastes bitter. So Plato says, for Protagoras, wine is therefore bitter and sweet at the same time, which is a contradiction. If man is the measure of all that is, then wine is both bitter and sweet, because, men at different times, whether they're healthy or sick, measure it to be different. Rosengren uses this as a way to show how different their interpretations are. He thinks that people are the measure of things not by drinking wine or, receiving a taste that varies between people, meaning that the truth of the taste of the wine is similarly variable. He thinks that rather, the fact that we have a way of distinguishing wine from other liquids, from other things, and that we have these categories of bitter and sweet, this is how people are the measure of things. Not by having things like taste buds that do the measuring, but by splitting up the blooming, buzzing confusion of life into categories. What we talked about in episode 4.1. By creating this rubric, this common ground that allows for Plato and Protagoras to argue about wine and its taste in the first place. Humans are the measure of things because there's no way to access the objective world outside of these human creations, or at least no way to access it and obtain knowledge about it in a logos type way, I guess. Maybe there are other forms of knowledge. But anyways, knowledge is more about creating than recording. That's the argument. If someone, let's say someone from some Amazonian tribe that doesn't have wine and hasn't even encountered it, if someone from that tribe somehow wound up in ancient Greece and lived there for a while, it would take them a while to understand what is meant by wine. Their first encounter with wine might be a Greek citizen giving them some at some sort of festivity, and they go, "Oh, you've never had wine before, you have to try it, I insist." And the Amazonian takes some sips, enjoys it, says thank you, starts to feel a little bit funny. But then at the same party, they're handed another glass by someone else, and they take some sips, and while it does taste different, it tastes somewhat similar to the earlier wine. And the Amazonian says to his new friend, "Oh, thank you so much for this wine, it's delicious." And this Greek guy goes, "What? That's not wine, that's pomegranate juice." And the Amazonian thinks about it, asks some questions, and realizes that kind of a necessary part of wine is alcohol, the stuff that made him feel funny. It's not quite the same thing as juice, like the pomegranate juice that he's drinking. So he tries to figure out the boundaries between wine and juice, because this is him encountering a new doxa, essentially. And it takes him a while to be able to learn the difference in taste and feeling and everything. It takes him quite a few parties. Even the concept of juice is interesting to him, because the doxa where he comes from, let's say, the doxa of his tribe in the Amazon, doesn't have that category. Of course, he knows what juice is in terms of, like, the liquid. Like, where he's from, there's many more types of fruit than he's seen so far in ancient Greece, and he wistfully remembers all their various juices dribbling down his chin. But in the doxa of his tribe, each juice was connected to that specific fruit it emanates from. They didn't have any sort of operation or ritual or production thing that extracted the juice from fruit in a way that there'd be like a whole bunch of people seeing the juice without seeing the fruit, if that makes sense. There was no need to create this category of juice. Instead, fruits were simply seen to bleed, just like humans and animals bleed, and the mother of the forest, in her endless love and prosperity, made the blood of the fruit taste sweet to humans, just like how antelope blood tastes sweet to the jaguar. Pineapple blood was understood to be very different than the blood of a certain berry, for example. Nobody in this Amazonian's culture ever thought about creating a category of fruit blood that didn't include animal blood or tree blood sap. So even juice was a hard concept for this Amazonian guy in ancient Greece to wrap his mind around, at first, let alone wine. But after some time in ancient Greece, after enough parties and gatherings and picnics, he eventually starts to grow accustomed to this new doxa, this new common ground, and he acquires a new way of seeing. It's an interesting thing if you think about it. The category of wine doesn't have a fixed number of types. There's all sorts of different wines that can be, you know, red or white. We don't learn how to recognize wine by memorizing all the varieties of it. It would really suck if that's how we had to go about it. But how we do is a little murkier, a little weirder. I don't know how exactly wine worked in ancient Greece, so let's think about the current day. There are certain shapes of bottles and glasses that are associated with wine, also certain events. Like if a person's drinking a red liquid at 8 a.m. in the morning, they're probably, hopefully, drinking cranberry juice or Gatorade or something, not wine. Like, do you see where this is going? It's hard to describe in full because life is fluid and complex and all that, but there's a way in which we learn to see wine, how to recognize it. And in my culture and Plato's, that's part of the doxa, this underlying common ground that provides Plato and Protagoras a foundation on which to argue about wine and taste. A common ground that also allows me to talk about wine right now, and you likely understand what I mean. Of course, sometimes our seeing and recognizing and categorizing are wrong. Sometimes people drink cranberry juice out of a wine glass because those are the only ones that are clean in the cupboard. They really have to do the dishes. It's very embarrassing, something like that. But it's maintained because it works based on how society generally is. If all of a sudden there was a big fad for some reason where people would drink cranberry juice out of wine glasses, I don't know why, like maybe some sort of TikTok challenge, then the doxa would change. White wine being drunk out of wine glasses would still be clocked immediately as wine, but red wine being drunk out of a wine glass would instead be seen instinctively as a question. Red wine or cranberry juice? Is this one of those TikTok things? Rosengren says, quote, "Between the bodily commotion of individuals and the purported human nature common to all men, we find logos as a mediator, shaper, and tool. Neither uniquely individual nor equal for all, logos serves as the cement holding humans together. Everyone has his or her own logos. Still, logos is the property of all people. Logos is perhaps the most important tool we have for chiseling through and in the doxa produced by logos that we are chiseled out, formed as human beings. In and through logos, we give names and images to our sensations, perceptions, and experiences so that we can speak and think about them. Logos is our guide when we act in and upon the world. At the same time, logos and doxa constitute something that is not thing-like at all, that we are born into and formed by, in and through habits and rituals, and that we in turn shape and reshape. Logos lets us distinguish between true and false, between serious talk and nonsense, between what is sensible and what is foolish, between what is real and what is not. Logos is what guarantees our humanity. Unquote. Pierre Bourdieu is a somewhat contemporary figure, a French sociologist who died in 2002, and who uses the concept of doxa. We can update our understanding by taking a look at him briefly. Doxa for Bourdieu is that which nobody ever questions because it's so obvious, it's common sense, it's common ground that people accept without knowing why they accept it. It's hard to detect the doxa you live within. That's one reason it's good to travel and talk with people from other cultures. It's a lot easier for them to notice elements of your doxa. Another French writer, Edmond Jalbet, says, quote, "The foreigner allows you to be yourself by making a foreigner out of you," unquote. I love that idea a lot, especially for anyone who travels a lot. I think that's really interesting to think about. And for this episode, we can rephrase that idea slightly to say instead that the foreigner allows you to see yourself by making a foreigner out of you. Anyways, back to Bourdieu. Another thing that comes up when looking at Bourdieu's understanding of doxa is the role that power plays. Social power and social powerlessness both play big roles in determining doxa. For example, Bourdieu at one point talks about Marxist intellectuals and how they didn't really understand the doxa of the working class. These intellectuals would always assume that the poorest people in society would be, like, super into revolution. Because Marxists see poverty as not something natural, but something that results from the particular economic system we live under, capitalism, and therefore poverty is something that can be alleviated if the economic system is changed in the right way. So these intellectuals would look at the poorest people in their society, people who have to, like, you know, work a fuck ton just to make rent and buy food for their family, people who live in conditions that seem quite desperate, and these intellectuals would think, surely, if it gets just a little bit worse, revolution will come. But then it gets worse, and the people don't get one bit more revolutionary. And these intellectuals scratch their heads. But Bourdieu says that this is simply because of a difference in doxa. The Marxist intellectuals, who spend all their time reading about history and different societies and theories of revolution, theories of change, economic theories, they know that things can be different. Things can be changed. Societies have been radically changed many times in the past. Humans have lived in quite a variety of social forms, from egalitarian, immediate return hunter-gatherers to, you know, cities that seem more egalitarian in the historical record to, like, the worst examples of civilization we can name, like Nazi Germany or whatever. But the poorest people in society don't have time to do this. They spend most of their time trying to make money in any way possible and raising their kids or, you know, dealing with their spouses and social relations. And then in their limited amount of free time, they probably, you know, do something leisurely or hang out with their friends, right? Even if they have the time to do so, it would be very, first of all, very weird person. And second of all, they're probably not in a circumstance where the idea of reading a whole bunch of texts about revolution is really an option presented to them, unless in exceptional circumstances. And maybe that's changed somewhat with the internet. I don't know. But the point is, in Bourdieu's time at least, the poorest people in society see poverty as natural. Or maybe it's better to say, they see poverty as natural. Some people have to be in poverty. That's just the way it is. Although individuals, if they have enough luck, or talent, or hard work, or all three at the same time, can sometimes escape. Their doxa allows them to accept much more than the intellectuals expected, because the intellectuals were in a different doxa. But they accept it without knowing they accept it. That's the interesting point. For another related example, I'll read a passage from Bourdieu. He says, quote, "When you ask a sample of individuals, what are the main factors of achievement at school? The further you go down the social scale, the more they believe in natural talent or gifts. The more they believe that those who are successful are naturally endowed with intellectual capacities. And the more they accept their own exclusion, the more they believe they are stupid, the more they say, yes, I was no good at English, I was no good at French, I was no good at mathematics. Now, that is a fact. In my view, it is an appalling fact, one that intellectuals don't like to accept, but which they must accept. It doesn't mean that the dominated individuals tolerate everything, but they assent to much more than we believe, and much more than they know. It is a formidable mechanism, like the imperial system, a wonderful instrument of ideology, much bigger and more powerful than television or propaganda. That is the main experience I want to convey." Unquote. And I think by the imperial system, he means like imperialism, not like versus the metric system. Pretty sure, at least. But it's really interesting to think about doxa as like a formidable mechanism, a wonderful instrument of ideology, just because people accept it without knowing they accept it. It's the given. It's what Jordan Peterson calls the objective world, objective truth. Well, weeping, right? That's just Jordan Peterson's doxa that he's talking about. I am someone who was not raised Christian. I'm not Christian currently. And I've also not read too much of Jung, Carl Jung. So when Jordan Peterson talks about, you know, God and truth with a capital T, that is all very Christian and Jungian. It doesn't speak to me at all. I don't know what he's talking about, but he's talking about it like it's so obvious that, you know, everybody else is just blinded by ideology and only he can see what's really true. like I feel like this way of looking at things is not only interesting, but it's kind of a good lens, because when you only assume, when you have this like view of knowledge that's based on episteme, on doxa, it seems like you can go down some really bad roads. Like everybody knows the dangers that can come from overemphasizing differences between human populations and human cultures and stuff. You know, othering can lead to oppression, apartheid, genocide, stuff like that. So people are always like, you know, make sure to not emphasize differences between different types of humans, different cultures, stuff like that. And it's usually a good point. But I feel like there's also a danger that can come from overemphasizing similarity between all humans, kind of tied to this episteme versus doxa thing. Like, if you just assume that there is an objective reality and that everybody has, you know, equal access, everybody's going to think about it in the same ways, it can lead to some kind of faulty thinking as well. Like maybe an example is this interview I was listening to a while back with this Afghani author named Tamim Ansari. Very good author, you should check him out. But he was talking about after the Taliban fell in 2001 with the American-led coalition, and America was trying to, you know, maybe not, but they said they were trying to make Afghanistan into a democracy, and they would, you know, set up elections and stuff, and put a, and you know, they organized a government that would be elected. But all the leaders that were elected would, you know, take some money from the state, from the taxpayers, and benefit their family, their friends, in a way that everybody in the West called corrupt. This author was saying that, like, the only opinion that anybody had about, let's say the president of Afghanistan giving his family money from the taxpayers, the only opinion anybody would have on CNN or the New York Times was how bad this was, how corrupt it was, how, you know, isn't it tragic that even after all of this, the Afghan leaders still don't abide by democratic ideals. How tragic. But this author was saying that he talked to lots of Afghanis that he knew. And some of them, obviously, lots of them, I'm sure, had that view as well. But there were also quite a few who did not have that view, because This country didn't have a history of democracy. So when they heard about their president giving his family money before the people, he wouldn't just give everybody the same amount of benefits. He would benefit his family first. They would go, yeah, and what? Yeah, well, like, what are you supposed to do? Not care about your family? Like, they just thought it was the sort of natural thing to do. Like, what are you supposed to do? See your son and daughter and wife the exact same as some random citizen? And like, just the way he put it like that was interesting to me, because it frames it in a way that you can see how that would make sense to somebody. It's not just like they love corruption or something. It's just that they had different ways of thinking about society and things. That didn't have this tradition of democracy and that sort of thinking that comes from it, and liberalism and stuff. And you know, like, you can see how if you just assume that everybody in Afghanistan hates this corruption and stuff, you can advocate for just more and more war, when maybe the people there think about things in a different way because they have a different doxa, right? Anyways, that was just an example that came to mind. Bourdieu has a really cool passage where he writes about journalists, because if you're like me and you've been online a bit or more than a bit in the last decade, you might have seen journalists really embarrassing themselves on Twitter, especially. Journalists and those other similar occupations, like opinion columnists or whatever, I think it has to do with them being on Twitter all the time and encountering a broader set of opinions than those allowed on television or the opinion pages of the New York Times. And of course, you can simply dislike the journalists who disagree with you and like the journalists that agree with you, like most people, and like I will still continue to occasionally do. But you can also take the doxological view and dislike all journalists. JK, JK. But it's actually a cool lens to view how journalists are, because imagine this combined with the internet, where now you can make fun of journalists for free to their face on Twitter. But don't get too cocky, because really this applies to all of us. We all have our own doxa and logos. But it's just that some doxas are more actively combated with the internet. Like, before the internet, journalists, like some CNN talking head, would never encounter somebody who, you know, believed that, like, lizards run the government or whatever, or believed that, you know, the America was an empire, something like that. Anyways, Bourdieu says, quote, "It remains true that, like other fields, the journalistic field is based upon a set of shared assumptions and beliefs, which reach beyond differences in positions and opinion. These assumptions operate within a particular set of mental categories. They reside in a characteristic relationship to language and are visible in everything implied by a formulation such as, it's just made for television. These are what supply the principle that determines what journalists select both within social reality and among symbolic productions as a whole. There is no discourse, scientific analysis, political manifesto, whatever, and no action, demonstration, strike, that doesn't have to face this trial of journalistic selection in order to catch the public eye. The effect is censorship, which journalists can practice without even being aware of it. They retain only the things capable of interesting them and keeping their attention, which means things that fit their categories and mental grid, and they reject as insignificant or remain indifferent to symbolic expressions that ought to reach the population as a whole," unquote. So, you know, a bit different than what I was talking about at the beginning there, but I just love that phrase, the trial of journalistic selection. It's really interesting. So for Bourdieu, doxa are like this, different in different social groups, because doxa is largely socially created. But you can't describe a doxa with the precision of, is it a one or a zero? Things are a lot more nebulous because social fields are fluid and constantly interacting or even containing other social fields. There are social fields within another social field that defines itself in relation to the doxa of the larger social field. That's maybe there's some semantic satiation going on there. But for an example, like the doxa of a typical high school, it has a common ground, the simplest aspect of which is stuff like it's bad to be late and don't curse. When students are late and they go, ah, shit, sorry. And when they're admonished for saying shit, they say, I'm sorry again. They don't argue about how clock time has only been a thing that structures our lives to this degree since modernity, so that everybody would show up at the same time to the factory or whatever. And maybe our newer technological and social modes are making this practice increasingly obsolete. And maybe schools should think about restructuring. And they don't argue that everyone swears online all the time, and every student except for that super religious kid in the corner logs onto the internet every day after school and sees tons of swear words, shit tons in fact. So maybe that practice of acting like it's a huge deal when a kid says shit is also an outdated practice. No, they just apologize and the class resumes. It's just assumed, it's not debated about, this is just how it works, right? But however, at the school we're imagining, let's imagine a certain clique. A group of friends that are, like, I don't know how high schools are set up socially these days, but when I was in high school, there were groups of fellow students who would dye their hair black, paint their nails black, wear black eyeliner, black clothes, and they would generally look kind of scary and skip class to smoke weed in the woods or whatever. And I was never sure if there were goths or emos or whether those aren't mutually exclusive, but I'm bringing them up because among this group, there'd be a different doxa, even though it often exists within the doxa of the school. If one of these black-clad teenagers swore, and their black-clad comrade admonished them, the group would be pretty confused. Or if they planned to meet at 3 at that certain tree, you know the one, and one of them showed up at 3:05, and one of the other people there sighed loudly and was like, ugh, Melissa, thank you for finally showing up. This is the second time you've been late this week. Please don't do it again. Melissa would probably not take too kindly to that. This is a very surface-level example. Maybe not even truly doxological, because people, they do know about these conventions in the different groups. But the point is that doxas intersect and nest within each other and have all these complex interrelations, relations that change as time goes on. So it's not something that you can exactly map or quantify or anything. The point is, in all these different social fields and, you know, how they and their intersections and stuff, there's always these assumed things that are the kind of the common ground that other arguments can take place upon. And keep in mind that both the rebel teenage friend group and the school exist within much larger doxas. The whole society they're in, for starters, that has a doxa. That has certain things that are accepted without people knowing they accepted them. But there's so many, you could list them for hours. Like, the doxa of the classroom, the biology classroom, let's say, is very much tied to the doxa of the committees that decide what should be included in the textbooks, and the writers of those textbooks, and, you know, who make the smaller level decisions on what to include. Like, do we just say that evolution is the survival of the fittest? Or do we put in a little blurb explaining that that phrase was invented not by Darwin, but by Herbert Spencer, a guy who really loved capitalism and the Industrial Revolution and the competition therein and the various hierarchies of power that existed in society. And in fact, there are other ways of understanding evolution that the power structures have been less enamored by, like Peter Kropotkin and others' work going back pretty much to Darwin. And people who focus less on competition and more on symbiosis and mutualism and within humans, like how we're a social being. A view that's been becoming more and more emphasized recently is things like the symbioses humans rely on to live, like gut bacteria have been discovered, stuff like that, right? There are many people for whom the survival of the fittest is doxological. It's accepted without knowing they accept it because they don't know about the alternatives. They just think that that's what evolution is, and evolution is true because we believe science. Anyways, the point is that for Bourdieu, doxa are different depending on the social group, but the social fabric is very fluid. There's no distinct boundaries between doxa within a society, and doxa are in constant change and relation. Rosengren says, quote, "However, society is not made up of sharply distinguished and separated domains or fields that do not communicate with or influence each other. On the contrary, a constant exchange of influences and interactions take place between the different parts of the social field. One result of this interaction is that each individual, using her specific logos, linked to her specific individual and social position, forms an opinion about what everybody else thinks and knows, likes or dislikes, that is, an opinion about what doxa is dominating in society at large, an opinion about what philosophers are prone to call common sense. Understood in this way, common sense becomes a designation of almost everything holding together a certain group, from what facts an adult should know and accept as true, how one is to behave or dress in this or that situation, to what opinions are correct to hold at a certain time, in a certain context or situation. This common doxa takes on the role of a, in a very wide sense, common conceptual framework or norm that you do not have to subject yourself to, but that you always have to relate to in one way or another. Each and every one of us can, from our specific positions in society, find reasons to question and revise what presents itself to us as commonly accepted. Nevertheless, we cannot avoid relating to it in some way or another when we act or think. Unquote. So this is a bit different than Bourdieu, because Bourdieu was really talking about like things that you don't know you accept, things you accept without knowing you accept them, whereas Rosengren is more talking about things you always have to relate to, ways of knowing, facts, styles, things like that, that, you know, if you don't agree with them, you still have to relate to them in a society. Anyways, let's bring it back to cave art. Can we better understand why it was Sans de Setuel's daughter who saw the bulls on the ceiling of Altamira? Why local guides and children seem better at seeing the pictures in history than scholars who had spent their entire lives researching prehistory and art? Let's now look at some more evidence for this, because something that seems this strange needs a bit more evidence than just a girl seeing cave paintings that her learned father had not. So let's go away from Altamira and into another cave, Neo Cave in France, now understood as one of Europe's most impressive Paleolithic rock art galleries of cave paintings. And it was consciously discovered in 1906. Consciously discovered? Well, after Emile Cartelac's Mea Culpa, it took 4 years for someone to be like, hey, wait a second, that Neo Cave might have some of that ancient stuff you guys were talking about. But before Emile Cartelac, before Sans de Setuel's discovery of Altamira, in 1866, a well-known, well-regarded prehistorian, someone who wrote many books about caves and Paleolithic people, named Dr. Félix Garrigou, visited, and his notebook from that day survives. He went into Neo Cave, and he even saw the images as images, right, rather than Sans de Setuel. So there's one note that says, in his notebook, there are drawings on the walls. What could that possibly be? On April 7th, 1866, he jotted down, the cave and corridor of 1,800 meters to the lake. Sans, secondary corridor on the left, and on the right, large corridor ending in a rotunda. Walls with funny drawings of oxen and horses? With four question marks after. And then another day he went back, a few months later, on June 16th, 1866, he wrote, in the large cave of Neo, traversed with the epileptic guide, one arrives at the lake of the bottom which prevents to pass, very abundant sand everywhere. Coming from the lake towards the entrance, we find the secondary corridors. On the left, a large corridor that has already been visited slopes upwards and ends with a large round room bearing funny drawings. What's this? Amateur artists who have drawn animals? Why that? Already seen before. And then, so an expert in prehistory in the middle of the 19th century explored Neo Cave, saw images of animals on the walls, but didn't think much of them. After taking these notes, as far as we know, he seems to have forgotten about it or not paid any more attention to these strange figures on the cave walls. that last note, he calls them amateur artists, so maybe he thinks it's, you know, more contemporary people. It's very strange. About a century later, the structuralist cave art scholar we talked about in 3.6, Annette Lemming Imperer, she wrote about Garrigou in a kind of baffled way, saying, quote, "These paintings, and especially those in the Salon Noir, cannot elude any visitor, no matter how uninformed. But Dr. Garrigou contents himself with entering that there are drawings on the walls. What could that possibly be? In his notebook?" Unquote. You may have noticed that there are two things going on here. The example with Sans de Satouilla and his daughter concerns perceiving. Sans de Satouilla didn't see the animals until his daughter exclaimed and pointed them out. But the example with Garrigou doesn't concern perceiving. He saw the figures without any help. He called them drawings. He called them animals. But even though he saw them, he didn't think that they were prehistoric, presumably, or important in any other way. Not just that, though. From the evidence we have, it seems like he didn't even think that they could be important. He didn't think that they could be prehistoric, right? Like, it'd be one thing if he debated with himself and asked himself the question, only to answer in the negative, like the guy who was sent to check out Altamira in 1880 and said that, no, the paintings weren't in fact prehistoric. They were made within probably the past 5 years. But Garrigou didn't even ask the question. He just noted them, moved on, and never returned to them, as far as we know. So maybe we can say that the Sans de Satouilla case concerns perception, whereas the Garrigou case concerns conception. What Rosengren is getting at, therefore, is that maybe doxa affects both our conceptions and our perceptions. We'll continue to build up to that. But when it comes to Neocave, we can go back even further in time. Rosengren says, quote, "We must remember that the painted caves were by no means discovered in the mid or late 19th century. Many of them were known long before, and in many cases frequently visited. For instance, in the Neo Cave in the Pyrenees, we find graffiti dating back as far as 1602. In the beginning of the 19th century, the cave was all but plundered of its stalactites and stalagmites to be sold as souvenirs for tourists at the time. The local guides who brought the plunderers into the caves had obviously noticed the paintings in the now famous Salon Noir, since they called it the museum. However, it is hardly probable that they would have thought of them as prehistoric or even antediluvian, as it were." Unquote. So this wasn't just the odd scholar coming across prehistoric wall art, but tons of people throughout centuries. It seems like it was widely known about in the region well before Cartalax mea culpa, but nobody thought the images might be prehistoric until, in the case of Neo Cave, 1906. The rock art specialist John Clegg, talking about rock art tours in Australia that he led, has witnessed this phenomenon himself. He says, quote, "Without knowing what to expect, it is almost impossible to see what there is. A certain familiarity with styles of pictures is necessary to see them. A guide often has to point out form in great detail before a naive onlooker can see the kangaroo at all. Once the onlookers have their eye in, they know what to expect and rapidly become expert at discovering items that have not been pointed out to them. The processes of getting the eye in involve familiarity with common natural markings on the rock and an understanding of the representational conventions used." Unquote. Rosengren likes this quote in general, but doesn't really like the idea of that understanding the conventions used bit at the end. He says it implies that learning this way of seeing is more conscious than and like rationally reasoned about than it actually is. It's not something that usually happens completely consciously. Like someone going, I think I will learn how to see Australian cave art. It's much more subtle, he thinks, and you can kind of see why. If going, I think I will learn how to see cave art was how it worked, and then it's a different thing from what we're talking about, because that person already has a conception of prehistoric cave art. All that's needed is the perception. The reason that Sansa Satuola didn't immediately see and Garaju didn't even ask the question, is the art prehistoric? And the academic body thought Satuola was a fraud for over two decades is because they didn't have a conception of prehistoric wall art. Somehow it seems conception and perception work together when new forms of knowledge are created, or when new things are encountered that can't be fit into the existing framework of that person's knowledge. So this is only part one. We'll continue to talk about this and unravel this more next episode. See you then.
Pictures!